Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Yesterday, a truly historic day, and I want to talk about that. Obviously, there's a lot of other things that we need to deal with, including the fact that we are going back to school, the debate about the FDA approving vaccinations for children. We have some fan mail that I want to discuss as well. The GOP sedition caucus is getting worse and growing. What a surprise. Donald Trump felt the need to call in and sound off about media coverage, called into the Todd Starnes show, in case you haven't heard it. This is the former president of the United States. We'll get to that in just a moment. But we're joined today by my colleague Amanda Carpenter, who has been watching all of this, all of these stories unfold over the last 24, 48 hours. So first of all, good morning, Amanda.
Hey, Charlie.
I was going to ask you where your rage meter is today, but let me get to that a little bit later, okay? Okay, so were you listening in real time when General McKenzie made his announcement?
I was not.
Okay, so let me just please, because I'm sure that you heard this. And then what I'm asking is what your reaction was, because I had a very, very mixed reaction to this. This is General McKenzie in the 4 o'clock Eastern time zone hour, announcing that it was all over. It was done. The final plane had left Kabul. The final soldier had left. The 20-year war was over. It was the kind of announcement that I'm not sure I heard anything quite like it, at least in my lifetime. I wasn't around, believe it or not, and I was not around when Dwight Eisenhower sent the telegram announcing that World War II was over. So this is the closest we're going to get to this. General McKenzie yesterday.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm here to announce the completion of our withdrawal from Afghanistan and the end of the military mission to evacuate American citizens, third country nationals, and vulnerable Afghans. The last C-17 lifted off from Hamid Karzai International Airport on August 30th, this afternoon, at 3:29 p.m. East Coast time. And the last manned aircraft is now clearing the airspace above Afghanistan.
Wow. So what was your reaction when you heard that?
I just find it hard to believe. I find it hard to believe that the war is over because there are still people that very much wish to fight us. And so we may not be there, but I still feel as though America is under threat. I haven't served in the forces. It's hard for me to talk about these issues.
Yeah.
But it seems like we are very much leaving things unfinished and unstable. And that's uncomfortable.
Well, my reaction was I was listening to this, and it sort of came as a surprise because I was waiting to do something else. And my first reaction was really relief. I was just relieved that it was over. I was relieved that that plane got off.
Yeah.
I have to admit that this was one of the things that I kept thinking about, how we were going to get out of that airport when everybody was gone, that at some point you have nobody at your back, right? Because you've turned everything over to somebody else. There's nobody running the airport. There are no soldiers on the ground. Now, obviously there was overflight, I'm going to be very interested to hear the story of how we provided that security, because that struck me as the moment of maximum danger, when you have to leave the perimeter, when you have to pull everybody on that airplane, and all you need is one RPG rocket. So I was incredibly relieved at that point. But then I had the same feeling that, you know what, it does feel like unfinished business. I mean, this is a moment of, this is a really humbling moment. And let's be honest about it. This is defeat. This is retreat. This is not a great moment for America. And then, of course, there was this from General McKenzie that if, you know, anybody was tempted to spike the football about this, I think this probably eliminated that reaction. General McKenzie admitting that we did leave people behind. This is what he said.
Look, there's a lot of heartbreak associated with this departure. We did not get everybody out that we wanted to get out. But I think if we'd stayed another 10 days, Louis, we wouldn't have gotten everybody out that we wanted to get out. And there still would have been people who would have been disappointed with that. It's a tough situation. But I want to emphasize again that simply because we have left, that doesn't mean the opportunities for both Americans that are in Afghanistan that want to leave and Afghans who want to leave, they will not be denied that opportunity. I think our Department of State is going to work that very hard in the days and weeks ahead.
Here's the problem. You've heard the phrase fog of war. There's also the fog of defeat and retreat. There's a lot of things that we know. There's a lot of things that we don't know. We don't know what we don't know. I don't know who to believe anymore when it comes to some of these numbers. And I told you, Amanda, a little bit earlier that I have this nagging fear that, you know, a month or two from now, we're going to read this deep dive in the Washington Post that will say, you know, all these numbers that we heard were wrong because of X, Y, and Z, or this is what was really going on. But the fact is that it certainly does look like we left people behind. We don't know how many people we left behind. There are people who say that we left lots of special visa people behind, American citizens behind. We have to sort of parse out what is the happy talk, like, hey, there's plenty of opportunities, and hey, we have this piece of paper with the Taliban. But the reality is that we took off and they're still there.
Yeah, listen, I get real talk and there's no happy endings really when it comes to this kind of thing. That said, I cannot believe we are hearing them say, yeah, we left people behind. And what are the other opportunities to get out? All the other private organizations that have flooded the zone to try to get all the refugees out so far. We're just going to cross our fingers and hope that, oh, maybe these little pipelines can get people out. We'll see what happens. As we all recognize, I think by now, if you're going to get out, there needed to be a plan to streamline the visa program and get people out that deserve to get out. But it just seems like the Biden administration is saying, well, we'll just get some people on planes and rely on the goodwill of other volunteers who are going without sleep, scrambling to save the lives of their friends. We're just going to hope that works. I mean, is that what they're saying? It's very hard to see like what the scenario is other than, oh, well, this happens.
No, I mean, there's something kind of surreal about watching these people come to the podium and saying that they will hold the Taliban accountable for this or that. How? Okay, we're gone. The windows are closed. The doors are gone. You're mentioning these incredible acts of heroism by people in the non-government organizations in the private sector, retired military operators. It's almost like we've privatized Dunkirk in this particular case. Well, of course, Dunkirk was privatized.
Any plan to actually outsource it. Just see what happens. And we know that people care a lot. And, phone a friend. This is the phone a friend refugee strategy.
Look, I do think that it's legitimate to say that that the administration inherited a really bad hand. I mean, we do have the Trump Pompeo surrender, the forced release of 5,000 prisoners. I think just as significant in many ways, given what's happened, the real slowdown on the processing of the special visas. Remember that until January 20th, we had a president who had once announced that he was proposing the complete and total ban of all Muslims from the United States. We had an immigration policy run by Stephen Miller, who made it very, very clear that he did not want refugees to come to this country. So to the extent that there was a tremendous slowdown in our ability to get Afghans out, we do have to look back at that. On the other hand, look, I'm sorry. I know that some people are frustrated at the level of criticism directed at the Biden administration, but this was a botch job, and there were a lot of decisions that were made that are highly questionable. I do think that it's also, the one mitigating factor is the role of the Afghan president. You read about the Washington Post had a great TikTok of the last 24 hours of the fall of Kabul. The President Ghani, who everybody expected would be able to hold on, was giving no indication that he intended to completely surrender. He bugged out of the country based on false information. Somebody told him that the Taliban was in the presidential palace. They were hunting for him. It turns out that was not true, but he left and he told no one. And no one in the Afghan government or the American government had any idea that President Ghani was going to bug out without any warning whatsoever that weekend. And that obviously was a huge shock to Americans, but it was also a huge shock to the Afghan government. And it was also a shock to the Taliban, who apparently were sitting around going, what are we going to do? Are we supposed to take Kabul? Are we supposed to wait? What's going to happen? So I understand all of those factors, but these images are going to be, this is going to be tough for Joe Biden to shake, isn't it?
Here's my problem. Why do we only look to the president and his administration to handle this? Like, listen, I have criticism for Joe Biden, but I also have criticism for the Congress that has completely given up its war-making powers to the executive branch. Yes, Trump is a problem. Yes, Obama was a problem. Yes, Bush botched some things. Yes, Biden isn't getting out in the way that we all want. But what has Congress done to conduct any meaningful oversight over this 20-year-long war since they signed, you know, the war authorizations in 2001 and 2002? You tell me, how do you spend trillions of dollars without ever defining an objective for success? You have 535 people who mostly have been completely willing to just throw this on the president's desk and complain about ever which way it comes out. I mean, I have a huge problem with that.
Well, that's true. There's no question about it. You know, it is interesting, a little historical footnote, that Harry Truman, senator from Missouri, became prominent because he headed up a committee looking into Army waste during World War II. I mean, this was a period of, you know, maximum patriotism. But back then, the Senate really did take its oversight responsibility seriously. And he ends up being named vice president as a result of his oversight investigation into waste. But okay, I completely agree with everything you're saying about the role of Congress, which increasingly, you know, seems to be okay with allowing themselves to be turned into potted plants. But the bottom line, the buck stops with the president, who is the commander in chief. And that's always going to be the case in, sure, in warfare. Congress was not going to specifically manage the withdrawal or the particular policy here. So this
Can I just push back a little bit on that? I mean, we've been in this. They voted for it. They voted for it in 2001. So why shouldn't we expect someone to press the administration to have definable objectives for success? I mean, we've all been dealing with this since 2001. What was the objective? To go kill Saddam, Osama, build a Western-style democracy, to make Afghan a stable country, to kill the drug industry? Like, what was it? Give me three things that we set out to accomplish. Impress officials on that. But this thing was so open-ended. And then when two guys decide to fly over there at the end to see what is going on, Seth Moulton and Peter Meyer, everybody jumps on them and accuses them of a publicity stunt. I mean, we're talking about two veterans of these wars. And I understand logistical challenges. It's not advisable for members of Congress to fly into war zones. But we're not talking about like Nancy Pelosi here, who you have to wrap up in bubble wrap to get off a plane. These are veterans of the war. They served over there. All I can see is that the Pentagon is pointing out to attention that was diverted from the planning of operations. Well, guess what? My attention was diverted that day, too, by the fact they went over there. And then they came back with information. They wanted to extend the deadline. And they said, yeah, you know what? We need to wrap this up. And so I understand that's controversial, but I give them a lot of leeway because of the fact that so few other members of Congress expressed any interest in this cause that has resulted in trillions of dollars in spending, thousands of people dying, and, you know, trillions, probably more to come, and a lot of strife and a lot of unevenness. And now at the end, we're all supposed to be happy. I have all these, you know, liberals, good intention, telling me, well, look at this, all the people we airlifted on such short notice. Yeah, that is an amazing feat. But why was it short notice, number one? And number two, was this the plan? Was this the ideal plan for the Afghanis to get out? Are they happy with the fact that because of this abrupt withdrawal, they had to fight their way through crowds in the airport under risk of death and the hope of getting on a plane? Was that what they planned? Was that their plan to become a new American? I don't think so. I mean, yeah. I'm glad they got out 100%. They should be taken care of. I support any kind of aid that they should get. But I don't think that was on their agenda for August.
You know, when I first saw it, I thought it was kind of a cheap shot. The more I thought about this analogy that's coming up, somebody was saying that, you know, focusing on how great the airlift was would be a little bit like talking about the Titanic in terms of being the most successful lifeboat operation in history.
The music was great.
The music was great. So, by the way, just, you know, in passing, you mentioned that Congress voted for this in 2001. I've been listening to a lot of the commentary. And to be honest with you, there are a lot of people that have kind of forgotten that there was a real significant political distinction between the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq was quite controversial. Many, many Democrats voted against it. Yeah. The war in Afghanistan was not controversial. Only one Democrat in the House voted against it, Barbara Lee. And it had bipartisan support up until America decided to forget about it. And
but so my recall is that there was never an explicit vote to go into Afghanistan. It was only for necessary and appropriate force against nations, organizations, and persons that planned, authorized, or committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th. I know, because I pulled it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the everlasting authorization of military force that has been used to justify a lot of operations in many countries. I mean, this is the problem. If you never define what you're going into, you can never get out.
So, you know, part of the debate right now is we have is whether or not this is a moment of really humiliating defeat and betrayal, or whether or not this is just a messy end to a misguided war. And there are people, of course, who are saying that, look, you know, Joe Biden deserves a lot of praise for the fact that he had the guts to be able to end this. Yes, it ended badly, but it was always going to end badly. Versus those who are saying, look, this did not have to be this way. We betrayed our allies. We betrayed our own honor. And 20 years of work, including 20 years of real progress in Afghanistan, has just been thrown away. So I don't know where you come down on all of that, because, you know, to a certain extent, this is why I think Americans have mixed feelings about this. People talk about, well, the American people want. The American people have not thought about this for more than a decade. The American people wanted it to be over. They wanted it to be out of mind. They didn't want it. They did not want it to be this way. And when you basically put it in front of them, do you understand that we have, you know, a generation of young Afghan women who, you know, built a society, and now it's going to be wiped away. And they didn't necessarily think of this as an endless war with American occupiers. And many of them never even saw an American soldier. And they really thought that we were going to make sure that they didn't return to the Middle Ages. So there is that element of betrayal. On the other hand, I do think that most Americans, you know, want our service people home. So, I mean, you know, this is the ambiguity. This is the ambivalence of it. This is why I'm sitting there yesterday listening to this and realizing, you know, I have such mixed feelings about all of this. I mean, I watched Richard Engel on NBC talk about, you know, how the Afghans are just, you know, are just horrified and disappointed and shocked by what we had done. And yet on the other hand, listening to, you know, the folks who say, look, we've been there for 20 years. We spent trillions of dollars. This was obviously a failed mission, military mission, and we need to move on. And I understand why both those arguments are appealing at the same time.
I guess on one front, I wonder what a lot of Afghan people heard when they heard president after president after president say we were going to leave the region, because that's been happening since Obama. Not that, you know, I'm not blaming them at all. I just am curious why no one believed that. But secondly, that's just as an American, we've invested so much in this project.
Yeah,
I find it extremely hard to come to terms with that we don't even have like an operating base there. Why don't we have anything there? We have bases all over the world. And if it only took 2,500 soldiers to keep this problem capped, I don't have a huge problem with that. That's not a forever war. I feel like there could have been perhaps some more creative thinking about why we need a permanent strategic base here, to just conduct operations and do training exercise with our allies. I don't know. I'm not a military person, but we don't have anything there now after all this. We don't have to create a Western-style democracy that holds elections to have an operating base.
No, I understand the arguments of people who say, look, given the fact that that Donald Trump had essentially given Afghanistan to the Taliban. I mean, when they made that deal, they had cut the Afghan government off at the knees, and the 2,500 were able to be were unmolested for a year because they knew we were leaving. So if Joe Biden comes in and says, "Hey, I'm not leaving, we're staying," then I do think he probably would have had to surge more troops into the country. That ceasefire would have come to an abrupt end. I appreciate the analogies that we still have troops in Korea and Germany, et cetera. But let's be honest about it. I mean, that's a very different situation. You don't have suicide bombers. You don't have an ongoing military operation going on, all of that. But I do think that I think that the decision to shut down Bagram Airfield and to leave all of those bases basically in the dead of night, I think those are going to look very bad in retrospect. Okay, so hey, did you hear that the former guy called into a radio talk show?
Todd Starnes,
I think, was fired from Fox for being too crazy and extreme, but he's got his own show, which means that the president's going to call in. I mean, the president of the United States calling into this crackpot radio show. I don't know. Anyway.
So, I mean, is it any different than Alex Jones? We know Donald Trump will call anybody right. who will give him an open mic.
All right,
I mean, so, if you said nice things about it for 2 days, he'd call you. Not that you're Alex Jones. Sorry.
It's very unlikely he will end up on the Bulwark podcast. Anyway, so he's calling in and listen what he's upset about. The former leader of the free world on the final day of the Afghan war, he's upset about the media coverage. Listen to this.
We have the people. They're not taking this. They are not taking what's happening in Afghanistan. And, you know, if you look last night, all they talked about was the hurricane. You look at CNN and you look at MSDNC. These are horrible. They're way down. Fortunately, they're way down in ratings. But all they want to talk about is the hurricane or anything else that they can talk about, because Afghanistan is not something that can even be discussed in a rational way. The level of stupidity. And we had a great agreement. In fact, even great Biden agreement. Admitted the other day he made a mistake because they didn't want him to say that. But he said it. It's probably the only truthful thing he said, that no people have been killed since this agreement was signed. We had.
Okay. So this is the drunk at the end of the bar thing. And yet there are millions of people who will be going, yeah, let's put him back in the White House in 2024.
Biden didn't is acting cover it. On the agreement I negotiated, and it's a disaster, and you should cover it.
Yes, but the whole idea that the media was spending too much time on that hurricane, they didn't want to write and talk about Afghanistan. Like, yeah, you may not have noticed this, Amanda, but there was no media coverage of Afghanistan.
Yeah, I missed that.
And here's the president's mind. It's that little insight into his mind that he's still talking about the ratings of cable stations and whether they're covering a hurricane or the war. I mean, the mind of Donald Trump is a truly disturbing place, but this is not breaking news, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, it's remarkable how less we hear from him just because he's been sidelined from Twitter. I mean, it's really a gift to us all. But I try to imagine sometimes what it's like in Mar-a-Lago, or I don't know if he's in New Jersey now, like how many televisions there are lining the walls, how many updates he gets from his little aides about who's saying what and what races he should get into and, you know, how much he should negotiate to get on Getter. I mean, it's got to be extremely weird. But they all think it's urgently important.
And it's still having an effect. Can I share with you some fan mail we got?
Is it real fan mail?
It's fan mail, yeah. It's real mail. It's former fan mail. Let me put it that way. There's fan mail and then there's former fan mail. Oh, you're thinking, is it quote-unquote fan mail? The, you know, Shirley Sakes and Amanda Carpenter, you built this. You know.
I was hoping fan mail, like, you guys are so awesome.
Okay, you know, here we go. So you can read that on our weekend newsletters where people talk about the Bulwark. Okay, but here's somebody, and I'm not going to name them, so don't worry about this. Of course, they're not listening anymore. But this person, Been listening to this, the podcast, for about a year. But now that we have a human being as president, your Republican guests are a bit too critical of this administration's best efforts in undoing all the meanest and stupid things Trump did intentionally. I'm done. So she's done with this.
Bye.
Well, no. See, look, I understand people's feelings. But again, you know, perhaps they weren't taking us literally or seriously when we said that we were going to tell you what we thought, that we were not promising you a safe space. And, you know, when those of us are, and we've clearly aligned with people who are anti-Trump and everything, but, you know, it's what we're saying at some point is, please do not sail into that iceberg, Mr. President. I mean, that's, but again, she's upset that we were a bit too critical. I guess I just want to say this, Amanda. See, democracy is holding your elected officials accountable, right? Holding, you know, them responsible for their decisions, you know, and criticizing, this is what's crude. This is the lesson that I've learned over the last decade, is that criticizing people on your own team is really important, because the alternative is when you start thinking of politics as just that team tribal sport, mm-hmm. And this is the mistake we made. It becomes part of your team, and you never hold them accountable. You never criticize them, because the other side is always worse. One of the things that I think that we committed to, and I think we were very clear about it, is that we were not going to be tribal. We were not going to be team players, and that we were going to hold everybody's feet to the fire. And also, I think sometimes to hold the people that you like, hold their feet to the fire, is also important, because you want them not to do stupid things that will blow them up. And, you know, we have several times been standing in the middle of the tracks, waving our arms, saying, you know, don't go this way. No, the bridge is out. This would be a really bad mistake. And I'm really struck sometimes, and you're on cable a lot, how many of the talking heads there, you know, made their careers as cheerleaders. And so they're kind of used to, you know, being part of the team instead of stepping back and saying, no, I'm sorry, this is messed up. I have to give you my best opinion, my best judgment. And I think that's what we owe the audience. I mean, if you want somebody who is just going to, you know, do the party line, there are lots of people who are doing all of that. But that's not what we're going to do here. And I understand that there are going to be some people who are going to be done with us, because we didn't take off one team jersey to put on another team jersey.
Yeah, and I think the point about sort of how cable news pits people into sides for the appearance of balance has conditioned people to think that if you speak on issues, you do have to pick a side.
Right.
We're not picking a side necessarily. We learned where that gets you through the Trump years. And I guess what it comes down to, and I think you'd probably agree with this, is that we don't judge presidents or anyone else by the stupid stick of Donald Trump. I mean, comparing him to Trump and saying anything that is marginally better is worth it and good and justified isn't going to cut it here, period. And that, I believe, is truly in everybody's interest, not only because it's the right thing to do, but Biden... You guys don't realize how much Biden has to do a good job.
Right.
The only reason he won the election is because he pretty much got it perfect. One little thing going the wrong way, Donald Trump would have won. Biden needs to be a successful president. Otherwise, it makes it that much easier for Trump to come in 2024. If we botch things in Afghanistan and exactly. We have terror attacks and COVID is never really managed and, you know, the threats to democracy continue to run amok and he looks like a bumbling fool who can't get a hold of the country, people are just going to walk away and look for that strong man once again. If he is worse than Hillary Clinton in 2024, Donald Trump will come back and win. That is why Biden has to be successful. He cannot afford to make mistakes. So if you judge him by the stupid stick, Trump is coming back.
I agree with you completely. And I think it's also important to realize that if they come back, they will be worse than the first time around. The radicalization of the right is absolutely a truly extraordinary thing. you know, part of the, you know, we talk about the, you know, the authoritarian temptation, they are normalizing the notion that we just use our political power to crush our enemies and do whatever we like. I mean, this is the anti-liberalism of the right. Would be manifested in a restoration of a Trump administration. So, you know, for people who think that, you know, this is just sort of, you know, partisan back and forth, look, Democrats have one main job. Do not screw this up to open the door for something that is genuinely ugly. Speaking of genuinely ugly, and I know maybe this is low-hanging fruit, but we still need to do it because I think it's important, again, to hold people accountable for what they're saying. So Madison Cawthorn is one of the most deplorable new members of the House of Representatives, along with the Lauren Boberts and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Paul Gosars of the world. And you may have heard something about this. He's speaking at a Republican county event in North Carolina. And among other things, I mean, he's an outspoken member of the Sedition Caucus. But if you want to know what we mean by the Sedition Caucus, it's somebody like Madison Cawthorn who is openly talking about the possibility of bloodshed. He's lying about the election. He said if our election systems continue to be rigged and continue to be stolen, which it wasn't, then it's going to lead to one place. It's bloodshed. Then he talks about, as much as I am willing to defend our liberty, there's nothing I would dread more than having to pick up arms against a fellow American. Okay. He also says, one point, I will remove Joe Biden from office. And then when Kamala Harris inevitably screws up, we will take them down one at a time. He mocks vaccines. He mocks masks. That's sort of routine, I guess, now. But he's also referring to the January 6th rioters as political hostages and political prisoners, and talks about attempts to bust them out. Okay, so if you think I'm taking this out of context, here's a little soundbite of Madison Cawthorn, who is, and stop me if you've heard this before, a sitting member of Congress and a member in good standing of the House Republican Conference, talking about the people who attacked the Capitol, who threatened to hang Mike Pence, who wanted to overturn the election. He has now retconned this into they are political prisoners, they are political hostages who need to be busted out of solitary confinement. Listen to this.
We are going to support the 535 Americans that were killed from January 6th.
Political hostages, let them out.
Yeah.
So this is something that we are trying to figure out everything out about. There are some criminal activities going on in my office. Literally, is sitting there. We have a mock block to be able to ask almost any federal agency any question we want. And when we're seeking answers, they are giving us the biggest runaround that you possibly can imagine. And so the big problem is we don't actually know where all the political prisoners are. And so if we were to actually be able to go and try and bust them out, and let me tell you, the reason why they've taken these political prisoners is because they're trying to make an example to say, because they don't want to see the mass protests going on in Washington. They don't want to see people redressing their government for leaving 13 Marines to die in Afghanistan.
When are you going to call us to Washington?
We're actually working on that one.
Okay, you may not be able to hear that, but even he's talking about how somebody says, when are you going to call us to Washington again? We're actively working on that one. Now, Adam Kinzinger, Republican of Illinois pushback, this is insane based on a total lie. This must stop. But he's got a fan. Okay, did you see J.D. Vance's tweet? Sedition elegy? Okay, so The Hill had a tweet. Cawthorn calls jailed January 6th rioters political hostages, political prisoners. J.D. Vance retweeted that with one word, correct.
Ugh.
So here's a Republican U.S. Senate candidate, heartthrob of Fox News, basically saying, yeah, I'm all in on this. I'm going to follow Madison Cawthorn down the sedition trail of thinking of these people who attack cops, beat cops. Think of the images of the way they were beating on the police officers and what they did when they took over the Senate chamber. And now Madison Cawthorn is saying they're political hostages. J.D. Vance saying, correct, former guy all in on Ashley Babbitt being, you know, his martyr. So,
well, they're asking everyone to return to the scene of the crime.
Yeah.
There's a rally coming up. You know, if you weren't worried about September 11th and the anniversary and what could happen, possibly after we left Afghanistan and you have terrorists looking for a PR win. Look forward to September 18th. I'm not saying they're the same, but I just, you know, I think about the Capitol being under attack and threat, and I'm scared for September. I mean, there's a rally being planned just for the January 6th prisoners to go do another big rally there. And, you know, they have their defenders. This is a peaceful protest, but they're asking people to come back to the scene of the crime for justice for the people who are jailed. There's people in the DC jail. It's not far from there. The cops are preparing. They're talking about putting up the fencing again. And I guess nobody can do or say anything about it. And Cawthorn is ratcheting up the pressure, saying, let's go bust them out. I imagine some people may get some ideas from that. I don't know.
So to your point, though, about why the Democrats shouldn't fuck this up, which is that they will bring people like this back into power. If Republicans, as expected, take control of the House of Representatives, people like Madison Cawthorn will be in the majority. Lauren Boebert will be in the majority. Marjorie Taylor Greene will be in the majority. You know that Kevin McCarthy will not discipline them, hold them accountable in any way whatsoever.
Talk about how mainstream the sort of aggressive posture is getting. I mean, this is sort of unrelated, but I've just been watching. I went to a county fair the other day, and there was a Republican booth, and there was a big gun, AR-15 image pictured in the middle of a flag. And this was at like a family event. And, you know, sometimes I've seen gun raffles, that's normal. But like at a Republican tent, there's an AR-15 displayed in the middle of a flag. And then I came home and saw Nancy Mace, you know, that nice Republican congressman from South Carolina. She's carrying a gun on her person at a Faith and Freedom event. I mean, this is like, you know, nice donor family event. Everybody else in khakis. There's an older woman and like she's sleeveless dresses. She's walking around, jeans, tank top, and a gun on her side. And that's such clear signaling. I mean, you know, people carry guns. That's fine. This didn't seem like the type of event where you would need to have self-protection, but it's a signal. Like, I am down with this.
What makes it particularly galling with Nancy Mace, and The Atlantic did a big profile on her because she had spent about 5 minutes being willing to go, okay, I don't want to be part of this Trumpian tribe right after January 6th. She seemed like a normal human being. She's now signaling, I am totally in on all of this stuff.
Yeah.
She knows better. But she has to, you know, play like she is. So, by the way, you know, in speaking of the normalization of all of this, I saw that you tweeted out about what's been happening at school board meetings all around the country. Mm-hmm. This is the other thing where, don't sleep on the kind of rhetoric, the kinds of threats that are going on all around the country where school boards are trying to do the right thing for their children and their staff, mask mandates, other sort of social distancing requirements, and people showing up making the wildest ass threats. You know, you have the one guy in Pennsylvania running for something or other saying that, you know, strong people need to come in and throw them out of office, you know, basically talking about coups. And there are a lot of school board members who are looking at each other going, well, we didn't sign up for this. Why are we doing all of this? And they're walking away from their jobs. And, you know, you point out this is sort of another form of compassion fatigue. People are just tired of it at some point. People in who work in elections, who work in school boards, are under the fiercest grassroots attack. It's not just coming from the top. You know, it's
metastasizing. This is a broader thing, Charlie. Yeah. I'm so worried about. You pointed out it's not just school board members, it's nurses. I also see it happening with Capitol Police. When people try to do the right thing and they go to the front lines of whatever their calling is, maybe it's in medicine, maybe it's in education, maybe it's in military, maybe it's to go work elections, and they are put under threat. At some point, they will act out of self-preservation, whether they have to preserve their personal safety, their mental stability, their family, whatever it may be. But we are pushing good people out in so many sectors, in the government too. I mean, there's a lot of people that will run for office right now because they don't want to go through the personal attacks and the threats. And what happens to our society when all these good people are pushed out by a vocal, agitated conspiracy-driven minority. I mean, this is just something I think about all the time because it seems to be happening almost everywhere you look. And these good people need somewhere to go and they need to be supported.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think people should underestimate just the power of political exhaustion. And it's not cowardice. It's just exhaustion. I don't want to do this anymore.
Reminds me,
I can't.
This came up in your conversation with Russell Moore yesterday. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was so good. You know, people should go back and listen to it if you haven't already. But when he was talking about how it always starts, and I stopped in my track and I rewound it a couple times because it spoke so clearly, is that these problems always start when the people who point out the problems are attacked for pointing out the problem rather than people coming together to fix it. And it's in churches, in schools, in militaries, everywhere you look. When the people who point out the problems aren't supported and are ostracized, that's the beginning of the end.
No, and I think that your point that they need to be supported is so strong because it is, particularly now with, you know, with the pandemic and the nature of politics, it's very easy to feel that you're completely alone. It's very easy to feel that you're living, you know, on an island. And, you know, some of us have been on an island for some time and we've gotten somewhat used to it, but it's a lonely feeling. And so whether you're fighting for voting rights, whether you're fighting for sanity in education or integrity in elections, I think it's important to have groups and voices out there saying, hey, you're not alone. You are not the crazy one. You know,
that's how we found each other, Charlie.
Yes, exactly. This is sort of our business model here. It's like you are not alone. You are not the nut job here. Not everybody is going along with all of this. If you decide to take a stand for a legitimate, reasonable stand, you know, you are not going to be completely isolated. Okay, so let's talk about, we're talking about January 6th and Madison Cawthorn referring to the hostages. The January 6th committee is moving along and they are aggressively going after, and I mean that in a positive way, going after phone records of a lot of people in Trump world. And I kind of feel the influence of our good friend Denver Riggleman, former congressman, who's been talking about this. I mean, he's been on this podcast talking about the need to, you need to preserve these records. You need to find out, you know, who was talking to who on that day. These guys are not playing around, are they?
No. I mean, the first request that went out went to federal agencies, asking them to look at and preserve all records about communications in the White House during the lead up to January 6th. And including, which I thought was interesting, attempts to place politically loyal personnel in senior positions across government after the election, which I think is key. And then there was another request on Friday that asked all these tech companies, Facebook, Twitter, Google, for reviews, studies, reports, analysis, and communications regarding misinformation. So not only are they looking at records of people in the White House, but also like what role did social media play? And I think this is interesting because a lot of people are looking at this committee investigation and be like, oh, who's going to go to jail? Like, that's not what this committee is going to do. The Department of Justice is handling criminal investigations, but this is really good because they're not going to let social media companies off the hook for letting these lies and conspiracies and organizing with the algorithmic power of social media off the hook. Right? They're going to want an explanation of why they did this, how it happened, how those networks worked, and they're going to come under fire. But then the one I think that is really getting the media attention are the phone records for all the people. So that was the last tranche to come through, and they're going to look at phone records for all the people you'd expect. I mean, Trump family members, members of Congress, Stop the Steal rally organizers. But it's not just, you know, who did they call and when? It's where were you located at that certain amount of time? What were your movements that day? And so when people describe this as sweeping, they are going after everything. And I've got to think that old Denver Riggleman hasn't been on Twitter as much because he's been working, which is great.
No, Denver's going to be a valuable asset. Okay, so, you know, we've talked about the Arizona audit, which was supposed to, we were supposed to get the report last week from the cyber ninjas, and apparently they got sick, and amazingly, they didn't come up with the report. The bad news, however, is this continues to spread around the country, and I'm sorry to tell you that even here in Wisconsin, where, you know, I at one time I had the fantasy that we were going to be a firewall of sanity, and of course that did not hold. We found out that we learned this morning that the Republicans in the legislature are willing to spend $680,000 of taxpayer money on a forensic audit of the election. So they're sticking the taxpayers with a $680,000 tab to continue the fantasy of the big lie. And I have to tell you that it's almost worse than it sounds like, because the Speaker of the State Assembly is Robin Voss. I've known him for years. Robin Voss is one of those Republicans that knows this is complete bullshit. He knows that this is a fantasy. He knows that this is crackpottery. And yet he feels the need, once again, to appease the crackpots and the nutjobs in his own caucus. And as recently as last week, the word was, okay, you know, we're going to kind of throw some bones to you folks out there. We're going to let this one, you know, committee, you know, send out subpoenas and things like that. But we're just going to go through the motions. They named a former Supreme Court justice to investigate this. Guy shows up at Mike Lindell's, the My Pillow Guys cybersecurity conference. I mean, you know how that's going. But because everybody feels the need to suck up to the orange God King, Robin Voss gets on a private plane and flies down to Alabama and then posts pictures on Facebook of himself sitting with the former guy. And apparently, as part of that suck up now, taxpayers in the state of Wisconsin are going to spend money that could have gone for school lunches, could have gone for hiring teachers or cops or firefighters or, you know, all sorts of things that we pay taxes for in the state of Wisconsin. They're going to use this to go through a complete bullshit forensic audit. And
well, don't think the costs are going to stop there.
Absolutely not. It's not going to. No one in Wisconsin thinks there was anything wrong with the election. We are used to close elections. We've had recounts. The system here is really very well understood. And see, the thing about it is the guys like Robin Voss are the ones who know better and yet feel the need to pander to this kind of crap. So this is another case where you have, the complete capitulation. So the party that used to be the party of Paul Ryan is now the party of going along with the big lie. And guys like Reince Priebus, who also knows better, he's got his fingers all over this thing. So Wisconsin's about to become an epicenter of a complete shit show.
Well, this is why I believe, even though the Arizona cyber ninjas haven't produced any kind of report, their audit has been a raging success.
Yeah.
They have proved a model that can be replicated in the states. And that model is you only need a couple of Trump supporting Republicans in the right places in state legislatures to unilaterally order for Senate audits using that state money. The Arizona model showed that you only need the state Senate president and the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. It can vary from state to state, but they have subpoena power and they can subpoena records. And what happened in Arizona is that they subpoenaed the election equipment and the ballots and other voting equipment for their audit. And in the process, they rendered a lot of that equipment useless. The taxpayers will eat the cost on that to the tune of millions of dollars. And even though there's still no report, it's not over. And it's because of other people willing to indulge in this madness. Just last week, the Arizona Attorney General, Branovich, who's running to replace Mark Kelly in the Senate, said that he thought the Maricopa Board of Supervisors wasn't complying enough with the investigation. Mm-hmm. And so he stayed out of it. And people have told me up and down, oh, he's a good guy. Yep. Governor Doug Ducey, he's a good guy. Well, at some point, they turn a blind eye to it, and then they indulge it, and then they're in it. So don't tell me these people are good people who are standing on the sidelines unless they're pushing back like that Board of Supervisors did, like Stephen Richer did. Because they're just waiting for the conspiracy forces to take them over, and then they will fold. And it's going to happen in Pennsylvania, too.
And these people, so this is why 2024 will be exponentially worse than 2020, because they were not there yet. They were not prepared to cave in to these conspiracy theories then. But now we've had 4 years of marinating in these kinds of conspiracy theories, this kind of big lie, and the pattern of caving in.
Let me scare people a little bit more.
Yeah, okay.
Joe Biden won by millions of votes, but he only won the Electoral College by 44,000 votes in Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia. And the Republicans and those state legislatures are ready to roll this time. By the time 2024 comes along, all the good people, your Brad Raffensburgers, they are gone.
Yep.
And they know and they understand now the power that state legislatures have potentially to cancel votes, overturn elections, send their own electors, and override the will of the people. These are practice runs.
Yeah, no, I agree, which is why I would suggest that all of the activist Democrats who are actively saying, we don't need you Never Trumpers anymore, you people, we don't need to make any common cause with you people like at the Bulwark, maybe want to rethink that.
At your peril. Sorry, I don't want to be haughty, but.
Well, that's not at your peril. I mean, it's like, look, you either think this is an existential threat or you don't.
Yeah, I guess it's at our peril. I shouldn't say at yours. I'm not being accusatory because I do think we're in this together.
But we are very much.
Let's be realistic. The infrastructure deal is not the hottest thing. It's not the most important thing right now.
No, it's not.
It's COVID. It's threats to democracy. It's Afghanistan.
Yes, I agree. So on that cheery note, Amanda Carpenter, thanks so much for coming back on the podcast. And by the way, Amanda's going to be sitting in for me next Tuesday and Wednesday on the podcast. You will definitely want to tune in.
And please do, because it'll be so embarrassing if I don't get the millions of downloads that Charlie does every week. Congratulations, Charlie, on again reaching a new goal. What was it? Was it 4 million? I did.
4. We're about to
hit. I can't count that high anymore.
Well, it's interesting because I was pretty jazzed when we were consistently getting more than 2 million downloads a month. And this month, the month of August, we will exceed 4.5 million downloads just for the month of August. So
amazing. Congrats.
Best is yet to come, we hope. Thanks for listening to the Bulwark Podcast today. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we will do this all over again.